Keith Thor Carlson, The Lynching of Louis Sam, BC Studies No. 109, Spring 1996. The only documented case of vigilante lynching in British Columbia occurred in the Fraser Valley in late February 1884. The victim was Louis Sam, a 15-year-old Solo boy who on the night of his execution had been in the custody of the British Columbia Provincial Police. The lynch mob comprised approximately 100 Americans from the border community of Nooksack. These men accused Louis of having killed one of their neighbors, a shopkeeper named James Bell. Within American society, vigilante violence had long been viewed as the legitimate means of establishing or re-establishing social order. The perceived fragility of European civilization on successive American frontiers had led countless vigilance committees to take the law into their own hands. However, it is doubtful that many of the American settlers who participated in or condoned the lynching of Louis Sam regarded Northern Washington Territory in 1884 as a particularly dangerous frontier where criminals were beyond the reach of legitimate law enforcement agencies. Indeed, young Louis Sam was incarcerated by Canadian officials within 24 hours of the murder of the Nooksack shopkeeper. The records documenting the lynching suggest that the crime was actually committed by an American settler from Nooksack who used Louis as his scapegoat. Canadian courts threatened to expose this scheme, and in response, the Americans organized a lynching. By representing themselves as vigilantes, complete with costumes, Nooksack settlers cloaked themselves, literally as well as figuratively, in the respectable garb of 19th century American vigilantism. Initially, Canadian officials were more concerned with the implications of the violation of territorial sovereignty than with the murder of an Indian boy. Not until Aboriginal leaders indicated that they intended to retaliate did the Canadians make serious efforts to identify and punish Louis's lynchers. Motivated by fear of full-scale cross-border Indian war, Canadian federal officers secured a promise from the Solo leadership that, for a time, the matter would be left in the hands of the Canadian legal system. The province launched an official undercover police investigation and coroner's inquest, and diplomatic cables from Victoria and Ottawa solicited American assistance to bring the vigilantes to justice, yet nothing came of these initiatives. Although the Solo repeatedly asked for meetings with federal government agents in Victoria to discuss follow-up actions, the requests were deferred. As the months passed, Solo attention was drawn away by other, less dramatic but more immediate concerns. When the threat of a cross-border Indian war diminished, the Canadian resolve to solve the crime dissipated, as did the federal and provincial government's political will to proceed. The Solo decision to entrust the punishment of the American lynchers to the Canadian government illustrates the pragmatic nature of Coast Salish leadership and provides insights into Aboriginal concepts of justice in relation to Canadian law. The Solo leaders appear to have considered that they could fulfill traditional cultural obligations to maintain a blood balance within a new Canadian legal context. For a number of reasons, the Solo anticipated that the Canadian legal system was willing, within certain boundaries, to deal with Aboriginal people on Aboriginal terms. In traditional Coast Salish society, perpetrators of real or perceived injury and or insult were expected to make restitution to the victim's extended family. Failure to do so invited acts of revenge. Raids and murders were answered with counter-raids, which, in the early contact period at least, almost inevitably led to more raiding. Solo leaders were responsible for their community's physical, social, and material well-being. As such, they appreciated the implications of ever-increasing American and Canadian settlement in relation to rapid Aboriginal demographic decline and political marginalization. Given these circumstances, when faced with Louis's murder, the Solo leaders cautiously promoted accommodation with the new Canadian regime while retaining the option of autonomous action. Thus, by allowing the Canadians to assume responsibility for punishing Louis's murderers, they hoped to satisfy the legitimate Solo desire for revenge while simultaneously eliminating the risk of further American retaliation. On February 24, 1884, Two Nooksack residents noticed smoke rising from the direction of a local shopkeeper's residence. Rushing to the source, they found James Bell's home and dry goods store in flames. On the floor, a few feet from the fire, they discovered the merchant's lifeless body. Blood still flowed from a fresh bullet hole in the back of his head. Immediately, everyone assumed that theft was the motive for the crime, for it was known that Bell had $500 in gold in his home. The last person to talk to Bell was William Osterman, who, in his capacity as telegraph operator, claimed to have visited Bell earlier that day and to have overheard, in the back room, a loud and angry discussion between the shopkeeper and an unknown stranger. While waiting for the sheriff, some of the locals conducted an informal investigation, which, they later claimed, led to the discovery of footprints leading to a nearby swamp. Later that day, a teenage boy named Peter Harkness reported seeing an adolescent Canadian Indian named Louis Sam traveling back along the Whatcom Trail towards what is now Abbotsford, British Columbia. Years later, Harkness recalled that the look on the Indian's face as he approached me struck me with terror. I moved to the far side of the road in passing him. Others confirmed that Louis Sam had been seen in the area earlier that day carrying a musket. This circumstantial evidence was all that was needed to convince Nooksack settlers of Louis's guilt. After surveying the scene, Whatcom County Sheriff Stuart Leckie traveled to Sumas, British Columbia, to report the murder and his suspicions about Louis Sam to William Campbell, the local justice of the peace. Accompanying the sheriff was the victim's neighbor, Robert C. Brackenridge. Campbell listened to the Americans and immediately filed murder charges, after which Brackenridge returned to Nooksack, while Campbell and Leckie rode to Sumas Indian Reserve to arrest Louis. Campbell seems to have attempted to explain to Louis that, like his father, who was then serving time in the provincial prison, Louis too was accused of killing a man. Louis was then handed over to two special constables, Thomas York, William Campbell's father-in-law, and J.L. Steele, who were to keep him in custody at York's farm before escorting him to court in New Westminster in the morning. Meanwhile, during the funeral ceremony for James Bell, approximately 100 men, led by William Osterman, Robert Brackenridge, Bill Moultrie, and Bert Hopkins, decided to take matters into their own hands. Returning to their respective homes after the service, these men donned their wives' dresses or skirts and put their coats on inside out. Then, in what might have been an attempt to mimic and mock the face paint and regalia worn by Stolo spirit dancers during their sacred winter ceremonies, the men tied sheets or sacks over their hair, darkened their faces with charcoal, and drew a red band across their eyes. So attired, the Nooksack Vigilance Committee headed north to Canada. As the self-appointed judges and executioners neared the border, they met the returning Sheriff Leckie, who informed them of Louis's current incarceration at the York Farm. The mob leaders then sent a scout, posing as a traveler, ahead to the farm. Later that night, after everyone had gone to sleep, this man, having managed to get inside the farmhouse, unbolted the front door. At 10 o'clock p.m., the entire York household was roused from its slumber when the group of armed and disguised men burst into the living room. Running downstairs to investigate, Thomas York was greeted by the barrel of a gun and told to release his prisoner. Constable Steele seems to have been disarmed before York confronted the vigilantes. One of the mob then grabbed Louis, tied a rope around his left arm, and dragged him out of the house. Louis was then forced onto the back of a horse, and they all started down the dark trail towards the border. A few kilometers down the Whatcom Trail, before they crossed over into the United States, the vigilantes stopped. Drawing around Louis, they flipped one of his legs over the horse's head so that he was sitting side saddle. They then tied his feet firmly together and slung one end of the rope against his neck, while the other end was tossed over the branch of a giant cedar, and then secured to a smaller tree across the trail. The mob taunted Louis, who, in the words of one of his assassins, remained as dumb as a brute. After a few minutes of being thus tormented, Louis was able to see past the disguise of the man leading his horse. He boldly addressed his captor by name, proclaiming, "Me get out of this fix, me fix you, Bill Moultrie." Shocked at his identification, Moultrie slapped Louis' horse, causing the rope around the young Stolo boy's neck to pull taut. After several long minutes of struggling, Louis died. Neither York nor Steele took any action against the vigilantes until the following morning, when Steele visited William Campbell and told him of the previous night's happenings. Together, the two law officers then rode to the nearby Sumas Indian village and secured the services of two Stolo men, known as Big Charlie and Jim York, respectively, to help trace the mob's tracks back along the Whatcom Trail. Eventually, the four men came across Louis' body swinging stiffly in the frigid morning air. The two Stolo held the body as Justice Campbell cut the rope. Steele and Campbell then studied the corpse and, reportedly finding no outward signs of abuse, concluded that the boy had not been physically tortured before being hanged. Big Charlie and Jim York, meanwhile, had been sent by Campbell to pace off the distance from the site of the lynching to the U.S.-Canada boundary marker. They determined that the lynching had occurred at least 500 feet north of the 49th parallel. Within days, news of Louis' lynching spread throughout the Stolo territory. Outraged, a delegation of approximately 200 Stolo from over 20 communities between Fort Langley and Yale in the Fraser Canyon gathered in a Chilliwack village to consider the best means of obtaining justice. The conference lasted over a week, as people tried to agree upon an appropriate response to Louis' murder. Into the middle of these debates walked Canadian Indian agent Patrick McTiernan. McTiernan had been summoned by the sons of two prominent Stolo leaders and the local Indian constable. He arrived hoping to calm Stolo tempers and to avert an escalation of cross-border hostilities. Upon meeting with the Stolo, he was asked to record on paper the Stolo people's feelings and intentions and to send that message to Superintendent of Indian Affairs, Dr. I.W. Powell. Through McTiernan's pen, we are the voice of a Stolo spokesman. Some of those present objected to letting you know anything about our intentions until it was all over, but the majority have decided to tell you everything and to take your advice. McTiernan was told that some of the most determined men believed that the Stolo community had a perfect right to hang and kill 65 Americans in order to avenge the outrage committed against one of its members. On his second day at the meeting, McTiernan recorded that those gathered were unanimous in feeling fully justified in going immediately in very large numbers across the boundary line and taking the first white man they met and bringing him to the spot where they hung the Indian and treating him in the same manner. Stolo discussions were not restricted to debating how many lives would meet their cultural requirements for revenge. Significantly, the Stolo leaders believed that if justice were to be served, they would have to determine who was guilty of murdering James Bell. Possibly, a retaliatory raid would have been perceived as less justified had they believed Louis to have been guilty of Bell's murder. As mentioned, Coast Salish society was, and continues to be, organized around the extended family. Families are viewed as collective social units. To injure a member of a Stolo family was to injure the entire kin group. This being the case, retaliatory raids were not necessarily made against the individual who committed the crime. They could be made against any member of that individual's extended family. After considerable discussion, and from evidence likely provided by Louis to his family prior to his arrest, the Stolo determined that William Osterman, the Nooksack telegraph operator, was Bell's killer. Therefore, the Stolo believed that they would be justified in retaliating against Osterman's kin group. That the Stolo leaders likely did not know which American settlers were Osterman's true blood relatives probably did not matter. In the Halkomelem language, the word for family and the word for friends is the same. Moreover, the American community had acted collectively against Louis, a fact which likely allowed the Stolo to view the Nooksack settlers as a hostile kin group. According to the Stolo version of what happened, as recorded by McTiernan in the local newspaper, Osterman orchestrated events to shield his own guilt and to direct suspicion towards Louis. The American telegraph operator had invited the young Stolo to travel with him along the Whatcom Trail towards Bell's home on the pretext of employing him to repair the telegraph line. Then, just as they approached the shopkeeper's establishment, The telegraph operator pretended to have changed his mind and told Louis to go away, which he did. Osterman apparently then murdered Bell and quickly rode away from the scene of the crime, correctly assuming that others would see Louis near Bell's store, both before and after the incident, and draw the obvious conclusion. If the Stolo version of events is correct, then Osterman no doubt assumed that Louis would be quickly arrested and summarily disposed of by a jury consisting of Bell's neighbors. This plot would have succeeded had Louis not discovered that people were looking for him. So informed, he headed south before doubling back through the forest to rejoin the Whatcom Trail and escape to Canada. This unforeseen development apparently forced Osterman to rethink his plans and to organize the bold cross-border lynching. Leaving matters in the hands of the British court system was too risky, as Louis would be provided with a translator and permitted to recount his own version of what had occurred. There was a real risk that the Canadian courts might actually give credence to Indian testimony. After explaining matters to the Indian government, the Stolo leaders asked McTiernan to let the government know how sick our hearts are, and we all promise you that we will go back to our homes and leave the matter at present in the hands of the Dominion government. We hope you will meet us again about the 1st of May. Upon learning that the Stolo would wait before attacking the Nooksack settlers, McTiernan lost no time in assuring those gathered that Her Majesty's government would prove worthy of their trust. The Stolo leadership's decision to leave the matter temporarily with the Dominion government suggests that they were not so much submitting to Canada's legal jurisdiction as they were adapting to altered circumstances and exploiting new opportunities. They acted independently, cautiously opting to test the Canadian system while reserving for themselves the right to act in their own fashion should the experiment prove unsatisfactory. The Canadian legal system, as presented by McTiernan, offered the possibility of restoring a Stolo-American blood balance without precipitating a potentially endless series of retaliatory and counter-retaliatory raids like those characteristic of disputes between Coast Salish communities during the fur trade era. If the Americans responded with renewed hostility, it was reasonable to assume that their actions would be directed at the Canadian government, not at the Stolo communities. Their decision to involve the Canadian government does not suggest that 19th century Coast Salish and Canadian concepts of justice were synonymous. Rather, it indicates that McTiernan's assurances gave the Stolo the impression that the two systems were similar enough for Canadian legalism to accommodate Indigenous requirements concerning vengeance and restitution. The Stolo were probably also encouraged by some of their earlier experiences with the police and the Canadian justice system, both of which appear to have generally proven satisfactory to Stolo and British Columbian authorities alike. Colonial and provincial police records from the 1860s and 1870s indicate that Stolo communities not only sometimes cooperated with the police in apprehending and prosecuting accused Aboriginal murderers, but they also worked with the police on cases involving conflict between Stolo people, or their close neighbors, and British and American citizens. Immediately upon receiving Stolo assurances, the Indian agent set in motion a series of diplomatic and bureaucratic events which ultimately involved BC Indian Superintendent I.W. Powell, B.C. Provincial Chief Inspector C. Todd, B.C. Attorney General Alexander Davis, Premier William Smithy, Lieutenant Governor Cornwall, who, like the Governor General of the Dominion, was at that time more than just a figurehead, Governor General Le Marquis de Lansdowne, and Prime Minister John A. Macdonald. In considering the lynching, Macdonald anticipated that the Americans would much regret having the matter brought to their attention, and even joked to the Governor General that making the issue a priority would be one way of paying the Yankees back for complaining each time an Eastern Canadian Indian happened to appropriate a horse or cow across the frontier. Yet while the Prime Minister could make light of the lynching, he found the possibility of Stolo reprisals against the Nooksack settlers a serious matter. Such actions had the potential to develop into a full-scale cross-border Indian war. To forestall such a development, Ottawa and Victoria requested that officials in Washington, D.C. identify the leaders of the lynch mob so that appropriate actions could be initiated and the Stolo placated. In the meantime, on the afternoon following the lynching, Attorney General Davis had already sent a telegram directly to Governor William A. Newell of Washington Territory, asking him to instruct this police to watch out for and arrest members of the lynch mob on their return pending our application for extradition. Ottawa's concerns, relayed through the American capital, reached Governor Newell a little later than did the provincial cables. Responding to both, Newell directed the prosecuting attorney of the 3rd Judicial District in Port Townsend, C.M. Bradshaw, to act immediately and vigorously against the leaders of the lynch mob, so that they could be extradited to Canada. However, at this point, the international paper chase, like the American investigation, stopped. Without the necessary investigative resources, Bradshaw could not and would not act. Months later, in justifying the prosecutor's inaction to Canadian authorities, Governor Newell offered the following defense. It is well nigh impossible to make discoveries of a band of disguised people who, with the entire community, are interested in the secrecy which pertains to such illegal and violent actions. Furthermore, many of the people oft-times make but little account of an Indian's life when any act which they assume to justify hanging by a mob has been perpetrated, and are oft-times not fastidious about the guilt of their actions. These comments suggest that either Bradshaw neglected to contact Sheriff Leckie, or that the latter somehow managed to forget the names of the men he himself had directed to the York Farm. Meanwhile, provincial authorities in Victoria were not content to wait for action from Washington. Accordingly, within a week of the lynching, the chief of the provincial police assigned two undercover detectives to the case. The first, a Mr. Clark, interviewed settlers at Sumas before traveling south of the border incognito. After spending a few days in each of the tiny communities along the Nooksack River, he determined the identity of a number of the lynchers. Sheriff Leckie's traveling partner, Robert Brackenridge, was so proud of his participation in the lynching that after describing Louis's death in grim detail, he boasted, "I would kill a Chinaman as quick as I would an Indian, and I would kill an Indian as quick as I would a dog." Other settlers were equally bold, stating that if the Stolo made any more trouble, people would come all the way from Seattle to kill every Indian they could get their hands on. All the while, Whatcom County newspapers confirmed that Nooksack residents were itching for a chance to clean out the entire band of murdering, thieving redskins. The Fourth Estate warned that, if the Stolo attempted to gain redress for the international lawlessness of the vigilantes, then Her Majesty would be minus a lot of dusky subjects. Not surprisingly, the Nooksack settlers quickly grew suspicious of the inquisitive Clark. They guessed his identity and threatened that, unless he returned to Canada immediately, he would certainly catch an incurable throat disease. Charles Russell, the second undercover detective, was less successful than Clark was in adducing admissions of guilt, but he did learn that Special Constable York had suddenly taken an extended vacation to Seattle, apparently because his life had been threatened by the Stolo, who blamed him for letting the mob hang Louis. Rumor had it that York had actually sent for the mob and was now afraid the British authorities would discover his involvement. Russell became so interested in York's role in the matter that he boarded the steamship and followed him to Seattle, spending a couple of days waiting for an opportunity to get him drunk and work him. But York kept close to his wife, thus denying Russell his chance. Discouraged by his lack of success in Seattle, Russell returned to Nooksack and learned that there were other American settlers who had stronger motives and more opportunities to kill James Bell than did Louis Sam. Apparently, James Bell and his wife Annette were estranged, and for nearly a year, the latter had been living with, and appears to have been married to, none other than mob ringleader David Harkness, the father of the boy who claimed to have seen Louis sneaking back to Sumas after the murder. Apparently, Bell had never accepted what he considered to be his wife's adultery, and he had recently quarreled with Harkness. Local gossip maintained that Bell was making arrangements to take Harkness and his new bride to court over the affair. For his part, David Harkness was determined to stand up to Bell, and he mustered the support of his influential family. Harkness's sister was married to the telegraph operator William Osterman, the fellow whom the Stolo considered guilty of the murder. Osterman sided with his brother-in-law against Bell, and as mentioned, was known to be the last person to have seen him alive. In fact, he was seen galloping away from Bell's house only minutes before the fire and murder were detected. A number of Osterman's neighbors shared the Stolo view that he had killed James Bell. And if the Stolo supplied an explanation of how Osterman murdered Bell and framed Louis, The results of Detective Clark's investigation provided a motive. Aside from wanting to protect his brother-in-law from the expense and scandal of a legal battle, Osterman and his family stood to benefit financially from Bell's death, assuming he died before he could legally prove Annette's infidelity. Bell died intestate, and all his wealth went to his and Annette's 10-year-old son, James Jr. It did not take long for Annette to become the legal guardian of young Jimmy, and thereby gain full control of her murder husband's assets. This entire process was expedited when James Harkness, David's father, was appointed executor of the Bell estate. Adding further intrigue, James Harkness secured his son-in-law, William Osterman, as appraiser of the Bell estate. After estimating the value of Bell's assets at $613.84, the Harkness clan immediately auctioned it off. Significantly, the fees the two men drew for their work on the Bell estate consumed nearly half of its total value. The remainder went to Annette. After receiving their share, David and Annette used their newfound wealth to establish a dry goods store, thereby taking advantage of the void created by the sudden closing of James Bell's establishment. Louis, for his part, was an easy target. As an Indian, he was subject to prevalent racist stereotypes. Moreover, newspapers like New Westminster's British Columbian and the Whatcom County Reveille lost no time in reminding their readers that Louis' name was associated with an earlier murder in the Sumas area. Louis' entire family was singled out in the press as a particularly bad lot. Canadian editorials commented that there would be few regrets wasted upon Louis' sudden exit. The easy tarnishing of Louis' reputation is, more than anything else, attributable to the legacy of his father, who was then serving time for murder in the New Westminster prison. Indeed, his father, Mi Sa Chi, is not even a traditional Stolo name. It is Chinook jargon for bad or wicked. If Bell's murderer had wanted to direct suspicion onto someone else, then young Louis was an ideal choice. The Canadian government never acted upon Detective Clark's evidence, nor did it make use of subsequent supporting evidence unearthed at the coroner's inquest into Louis' lynching. Lacking the support of American authorities, Canadian officials were faced with the daunting prospect of initiating extradition proceedings without the assistance of the American government. And Canada was reluctant to push the issue and so jeopardized relations with Washington. Apparently, the settler population of the Fraser Valley agreed with the Canadian government's inaction. In his report of April 30, 1884, Attorney General Davis summed up his personal frustration with the neglect of Stolo concerns. Even our own people who were engaged in the coroner's jury would have seemed to have been primarily animated by a desire to preserve the goodwill of their American neighbors. The Dominion government's only motivation to act was the continued threat of open hostilities between Canadian Aboriginal people and American settlers. In the months following the lynching, the Stolo repeatedly requested a meeting with Indian Superintendent Powell to discuss the government's progress in punishing Louis' murders. But their petitions were always politely deferred. That the Stolo remained patient suggests that their earlier experiences had given them what would prove to be an unwarranted confidence in the Canadian legal system. However, their patience may simply reflect the fact that, in Coast Salish society, it was not essential that revenge be administered quickly. Indeed, intervillage raids dating to the mid-1800s played important roles in intergroup relations well into the 20th century. Stolo elders, interviewed by Wilson Duff in the 1940s, explained that when numerous Coast Salish families from all along the coast arrived to work at the Fraser Valley hopyards, it was not uncommon as recently as the 1930s for people to seek out the descendants of those accused of raiding their community generations earlier. Such delayed acts of revenge were apparently so common that night watchmen were employed by hopyard owners to patrol the camps and keep the peace. In the case of Louis Sam, however, the Stolo did eventually weary of the government's patronizing treatment and gave up trying to meet with Powell. As Stolo pressure on the government subsided, so too did government concern. Despite the diligent work of individual police detectives, the Canadian government was never concerned with addressing Louis Sam's murder as it was with preventing an escalation of Canadian Indian American settler hostilities. For their part, American and Washington Territory officials never gave Louis Sam's lynching serious consideration. In the wake of Chief Joseph Nez Percy's uprising, and in the decade of the Battle of Little Bighorn and Geronimo's Apache Wars, investigating and punishing a group of American citizens for lynching an Indian accused of murdering a white was not a priority. We'll never know for certain what the average Nooksack resident, and in particular the members of the Nooksack Vigilance Committee, thought of the lynching. Apparently, after their own sheriff had proven incapable of capturing Louis on American soil, the community members determined that it was up to them to deal with James Bell's murderer. If, as it seems, the mob's disguises were meant, in part, to imitate Stolo face paint and regalia, then one might conclude that the American settlers were, in typical vigilante fashion, attempting to use appearance and costume to discipline the Aboriginal population. In discussing the transgressive actions of people within the context of the carnivalesque, Umberto Eco notes that, by assuming a mask or costume, everyone can behave like an animal. They can commit any sin while remaining innocent, and they are indeed innocent because they laugh. Within this context, we may interpret the mob's actions as an attempt to deflect accountability by transposing responsibility for the lynching away from themselves and onto their assumed personae. It has been argued that social status and or gender roles can be temporarily inverted when a group ritually assumes the role of its binary opposite through costume and or mask. The American settlers saw themselves as civilized and the Stolo as savage. Ironically, to protect their supposedly more evolved civilization from savagery, they needed to revert to what they considered to be a less civilized state by disguising themselves as Aboriginal people and evoking the spirit of carnival. Moreover, they needed to dehumanize Louis, to characterize him as a dog. Only after transforming themselves and dehumanizing Louis could the vigilantes themselves view the lynching as a matter of justice rather than as a crime. Clearly, when compared to the American settlers' response to the murder of James Bell, the Stolo response to the murder of Louis Sam stands as a model of restraint. To conclude, the rich archival documents describing the events surrounding British Columbia's only vigilante lynching provide much more than a fascinating tale of intrigue and murder. These records present an intimate view of three cultures vying with each other for control of their respective social environments in a rapidly changing world. We witness American racism and ethnocentrism in its most base form, the lynch mob, as American settlers were apparently manipulated by members of their own community into murdering an innocent Aboriginal boy. We witness the Canadian government preoccupied with preventing an open cross-border Indian war and unwilling to upset its southern neighbors over the wrongful death of an Indian. We witness the Stolo society concerned with maintaining a blood balance and determined to do so in a manner which is in their long-term best interest. The Stolo leaders acted without sacrificing their autonomy. The Canadian legal system was not forced upon them. They decided to accept it because it appeared to suit their purposes. The Stolo leaders demonstrated the flexibility that was so crucial to their cultural and physical survival in this pivotal era, an era of rapid Aboriginal population decline and increased American-Canadian social and political hegemony. Indeed, in the lynching of Louis Sam, we may witness the shifting nature of late 19th century power relationships on the Northwest Coast.